right, Chicago gave us the blues, and Chicago gave us Al Capone, which I get really sick of people when you're on vacation and you say, where are you from? Chicago.
Right.
Oh, Al Capone.
Right.
There's more to it than Al Capone, and we're going to find out about it now. John Seidel is with us, author of Second City Sinners, True Crime from Historic Chicago's Deadly Streets. First of all, how are you, John?
I'm well. How are you?
Great.
Thanks for having me.
You are a federal courts reporter. You are a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. And this book of yours is beautiful. Your very first one, huh?
It is. Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
More to our city than Al Capone, huh?
There's a lot more, yeah. I mean, of course, we talk about Capone in there, but I go back through a lot of crimes. I actually start with one that really kind of where politics intersected with the Haymarket riot in 1886 and the trial that followed that, which was really kind of a trial of the century for the 1800s in Chicago.
I don't know a lot about this. Can you give me a brief synopsis?
Sure, sure. So the Haymarket riot, there was a lot of labor protests at the time. They were trying to get an eight-hour workday, and there was a rally at, I believe it was Des Plaines at Randolph and Lake. And they were up there speaking. The police told them to disperse, and right as the police approached them, somebody threw dynamite into the crowd, and it went off, and several people were killed. I think 7 or 8 police officers lost their lives ultimately. And they wound up putting 8 men on trial for a conspiracy to murder the police officer. I believe 7 were sentenced to hang, 4 ultimately did. But the thing of it is, they never actually found the bomber. And the remaining anarchists, as they were referred to, who survived and who weren't hanged, were ultimately pardoned because the governor found lots of flaws in the prosecution. Basically saying one of the things that the governor pointed out was that you never showed that the bomber had actually listened to any of the things these people said and therefore couldn't have been incited to throw the bomb. So we kick off with that. We talk about H.H. Holmes, the person who killed Mayor Carter Harrison. We go through the gangster era, the women who inspired the play Chicago, and we go on into the 60s with the murders by Richard Speck.
Other cities, John, certainly have graft and crime and corruption, but we seem to build off of it, don't we? What's going on in Chicago? Why do we own it the way we own it?
Yeah, I don't know. It's really part of the city's personality, for better or for worse. And part of it may be the media. You know, one thing I tried to do with this book was dive into the archives of the Chicago Daily News, a sister and predecessor paper to the Sun-Times. And, boy, just the way crime was covered in the city, 100 years ago or so, was really something else. I mean, it was like reading a daily crime novel when you picked up the paper, and I think people just kind of hung on to every word, and then ultimately it just kind of became part of the legs, the fabric of the city, again, better or worse.
I like reading about it, though. Mm-hmm. I don't, and obviously everybody does. Richard Speck was an interesting man. Do you go into great depth on him?
Certainly in what happened in 1966 and in the trial in 1967. That was one of the tougher ones to write about.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's not pleasant. And I went down to the Illinois State Archives in Springfield to pull the file on Speck just to get, and there was a lot there. Of course, there was the one survivor who ultimately identified him at the trial face to face after hiding underneath the bed while he murdered her fellow nurses. And she, of course, gave a great blow-by-blow so that we know exactly what went on in that townhouse. And so we go through that, and I include, again, some of the coverage from the Daily News and the Sun-Times.
Did you get, goosebumps when you looked at that original file from Springfield? Didn't that just make the hair on the back of your neck stand up as you were reading it?
It does, yeah. And I mean, there's it's gruesome to read about. There are crime scene photos there, too. I mean, it's difficult, but it's also as... I don't know. Throughout writing about the book, I have to say there was a little bit of a connection, especially when reading the news coverage of the crimes. I mean, of course, I cover federal courts now. It's a lot more corruption, white collar type of stuff. But I've had my turn covering murder trials in the city, and it's something people have been doing here for a really long time. And so it's interesting to go back and see how the work was done back then.
Was the coverage dramatically or less dramatically more accurate? Like, were they really going out of their way to be gruesome in the description of these crimes back then, or did that happen later? How did that play out?
I think there was a lot of vivid detail in the old reports.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as accuracy, the one thing I'll say, you know, one thing I say in the book is that, you know, newspapers aren't perfect. They're just they're just not. And of course, there are some errors here and there. But I was actually really struck when I pulled the old historic records just about how accurate things were. And one thing I write about a guy named August Becker. He's a butcher whose wife disappeared, and he suddenly has a new sweetheart. We've kind of seen this tale before. But there was one kind of twist in the trial that I couldn't really figure out until I finally found the right court file. And it wasn't necessarily the record that explained it, but I looked at the date on the file, and I went and pulled the Daily News from that day. And there was an article about that very record that I had been holding in my hand explaining what had happened. And again, very accurate. Just as far as the details that were in the record, it was there. And I saw the same thing when I wrote about Leopold and Loeb as well, when I pulled the transcript from the trial. Again, really accurate quotes in there, I thought.
I remember Leopold and Loeb learning about it, but can you refresh our memories on that as well?
Sure. Yeah, so Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb were two rich teenagers who basically got bored and decided they wanted to try and commit the perfect crime. And
was it Bobby Franks? Was that
Bobby Franks was their ultimate victim. Yeah, he was a 14-year-old that they just picked off the street. But that was one of the things they left to the last minute after months of planning and trying to figure out how they were going to do this, how they were going to get the ransom. One of the last things they decided was who their victim was actually going to be, and they drove around looking for somebody. Bobby Franks was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And yeah, they picked him up, pulled him in the car, and there it goes.
But the genesis of this was just two rich kids who were bored and wanted to see if they could get away with a crime. That was pretty much the beginning of it, huh?
Yeah, and they thought they were smarter than everybody else. And in the end, they left behind two key clues. One, I believe it was Nathan Leopold who left his glasses in the marshland where they left the body.
Yeah.
But then also the Chicago Daily News actually helped figure out that, again, I think it was Leopold had his typewriter, that when you typed on it, that matched the typing on the ransom note that Bobby Franks' father got. And the Daily News actually got a Pulitzer for their coverage of the Bobby Franks murder.
Wow.
That's pretty incredible. We are talking with John Seidel. He is the author of Second City Sinners, True Crime from Historic Chicago's Deadly Streets. It's available now, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Your federal courts reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. We're going to take a quick break and continue. I'd like to find out more recent stuff, and if listeners have questions about some of our rich Chicago history, 312-981-7200. It's WGN. It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and we are talking with John Seidel, a federal courts reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, and his new book is called Second City Sinners, True Crime from Historic Chicago's Deadly Streets. It's available now. First of all, I have to tell you, this book is beautiful.
Thank you so much. And I have to give credit to the folks at Lions Press who put that together. I mean, I thought they did a really good job with the presentation.
It's why are we so obsessed with this? We were talking to you off the air. I just need to know every last dirty detail of things, but then I'm shocked and horrified when I hear them. It's probably just our nature. We want to find out everything we can about some of these cases.
I think so. And like I was saying, I mean, I've thought about that both as a newspaper writer and also as writing this book. And I don't really know what the answer is other than I just think we're all just kind of curious about the dark side, the underbelly, you know?
Yeah. Explain this, John. I've never understood this. The reporters that cover organized crime seem to have a safeguard around them. You would think, oh, they're around these dangerous people all the time. Their lives must be in danger. But for some reason, the syndicate treats them fairly more times than not. How can that be?
You know, when I was doing research, I mean, you know, I guess I'd say that back in the day, you know, especially maybe during the Capone 20s, 30s or whatever, I think there was kind of an understanding about the role that journalists play. They managed to move around in every world, right?
Yeah.
In the police world, in the mob world, and you know, and there was, you know, I don't know if it was because they provided some information on both ends. I mean, yeah. I think maybe both sides found some usefulness in them, and therefore just kind of let them move again, which with some understood kind of rules. I mean, I did come across some stories about some journalists not making it out, but I think that was when they decided to maybe try and get a little cut. Could it be guys
like Capone and John Dillinger kind of like the publicity? Could that play into it a bit?
I'm sure they probably did. Yeah. And I think there are rules in the organized crime world that protect them.
Hands off on them.
Yeah.
So this is a historic look back from like Richard Speck backwards, correct?
That's right.
leaves you room for a new volume, a new chapter in a new book, because there's a lot of stuff that's going on.
Sure.
What are some famous stories that we may not be aware of covered in this book?
In the book? One that kind of we were talking about that stands out. I mean, I did a chapter on the lipstick killer back in the 40s, which was really... It was really troubling, really bizarre, in some ways really gruesome, but one thing that drew me to it was that I just hadn't really heard much about Bill Herons. Bill Herons was a young man. I think he was arrested when he was 17. He ultimately pleaded guilty to 3 murders. I believe Josephine Ross was one. And I think Francis Brown, forgive me if I'm getting that name wrong, but ultimately the one that really sent Chicago over the edge was the murder of 6-year-old Suzanne Degnan, who was taken from her bedroom and murdered, and her remains were later discovered. That's like every parent's worst nightmare, right? Just the little girl in bed snatched out of her window. But there were a lot of questions, I think, about whether he did it. You know, he did plead guilty. But then he came back in the 50s and tried to have his conviction thrown out, said that he was given sodium pentothal, that he was beaten. The judge ultimately ruled against him, but there was, I think, a Supreme Court ruling that said that the law enforcement tactics were really questionable and should be condemned, yet we're not going to throw out the conviction. And then he spent decades really denying that he committed these crimes. And I believe, even though he was arrested in the 40s when these murders took place, I believe he actually ended up dying in 2012 and became the longest serving inmate in the Illinois Department of Corrections.
So not that long ago.
Not that long
at all.
Ago. Yeah.
Why the name lipstick applied to this?
Oh, yeah, I should explain that. I believe it was the Francis Brown murder. When they found her, so she had an apartment. There was a maid who came by to check on her. Door was open, the radio was on. They found her body in the bathroom, but somebody had taken lipstick and written a message on the wall saying, "I'm going to do the best I can."
Do you
here
want your book to look it up?
I don't know how quickly I can find it. Let me see.
I vaguely remember hearing.
I've
this
heard
now.
The name, yeah. But I never. I didn't know that it took place in Chicago or any.
So
of the
when
reference.
They. Here, I'll just read the lead from the Chicago Daily News on December 10, 1945. Francis Brown, 33, former Wave, was stabbed and shot to death today in her small apartment at the Pinecrest Hotel, 3941 Pine Grove Avenue. Before fleeing, the slayer paused to scrawl this message in lipstick on the wall by her bloodstained bed. Catch me before I kill more. And I actually think that it actually went on beyond... Catch me before I kill. But there was something along the lines. Oh, here it is. For heaven's sake, catch me before I kill more. I cannot control myself. Written in lipstick on the wall. And so that's how the lipstick nickname came to apply. And they connected Herons to the Suzanne Degnan murder through a fingerprint. And then ultimately he confessed to the 3 murders as well as a series of burglaries and robberies.
It's not fair to ask you this because you don't probably have the answer. But back when some of these cases happened, it's amazing to me that they were solved because they didn't have very many ways to find things. Now, with all the DNA, with everything they have, I find it shocking that some of these cases go unsolved. I can't sleep at night sometimes thinking about some of these.
Well, you know, it makes me wonder, you're right. I mean, I don't have all the numbers on the top of my head as far as conviction rates, resolution, you know, how many cases were resolved then versus now. But you're right. What's interesting in as I looked through these cases, there was always something that helped, some key clue that helped. I mean, we talked about Richard Speck and the survivor. Had that nurse not survived under that bed? Who knows what would have happened,
that's
right?
True.
Leopold and Loeb, if it hadn't been for the dropping the eyeglasses and figuring out the typewriter, who knows what they were going everywhere.
How could he have dropped his glasses? First of all, you wear glasses, so you need them to see. I just find that shocking that he would leave that behind.
Yeah.
Thankfully, he did. Mm-hmm. Also, John Dillinger, really all I know, he was shot at the Music Box Theater, correct?
Biograph.
Or Biograph,
which I think is, yeah.
Okay, so what was his story?
Well, of course, he was a bank robber in 1933 and 1934. He went to prison as a young man and said that he really learned the ways of crime within prison. And he came out and he helped his buddies get out of prison. They just went all over the Midwest robbing banks. And it was during the Great Depression, right? So it was a time where people really kind of saw him as a Robin Hood type, really. They didn't really hate what he was doing, that he was giving it to the banks. Of course, ultimately, and then there was the escape from the prison in the jail in Crown Point,
yeah,
which with a little wooden gun. He ultimately drew federal heat, and they tracked him down to the Biograph with the help of an informant and gunned him down there. And of course, as you guys know, he's been back in the news,
yeah,
and
yeah,
been writing about him for the Sun-Times.
It's always funny. He was always described as, yeah, he might be a mobster, but he's also a gentleman. You'd always hear that about him. Oh, yeah. All right.
A lot of these guys like that.
You know what's funny, John? As you're telling these stories, and I've seen a lot of movies, mm-hmm, I see that giant flashbulb going off. You know what I mean? Somebody's taking all kinds of
photographers. Yeah.
And that noise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. That's like a constant fixture in all these stories.
I can't wait to sit down and read this. It's called Second City Sinners, True Crime from Historic Chicago's Deadly Streets. And John Seidel is the author, federal courts reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. I hope you keep in touch with us, because
absolutely,
we are all so obsessed with what's going on. So
sure. Yeah, call anytime.
And really quickly, you told Wendy and I off air, but I want to say it on air, your wife convinced you to do this book. You must be thrilled that she convinced you to do this book.
I am, and you know what? Thank you. I should say thank you to her, too.
Yeah.
Not only for convincing me to do this, but just for all the help and the support along the way. It meant a lot of days where I had to go disappear and dig through records and write. And so, thank you to her.
It's paid off nicely.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Can't wait to read it. Thank
Appreciate
you so
it.
Much.
Thank you, guys.